I think we'll get started. So, hello everybody. Thanks for coming out and helping to celebrate this this new book, which is not so new anymore, but feels still new. Anyway, the theme of the evening is managing expectations. And I think everybody here has at least one expectation about something. Is that true? Yeah, so we can... Yeah? No? No expectations. Excellent. I was going to say that the only people that don't have expectations are the most enlightened. And there we have. So it's interesting for me, this kind of event brings together a disparate group of people from different realms in my life, from friends, business, family, and so forth. And one of the interesting challenges is to make the topic something that can be understood and absorbed by everyone in their all different languages and experience levels and so forth. So that's my challenge. So if I use any terminology or references that you don't understand, pick up your hand and ask. So the mindfulness is one of the words in the title of this book. The book is, you know, Managing Expectations, a Mindful Approach to Achieving Success. So we need to look at some of these words, and we'll start with the word mindful, and then we'll deal with achieving and success and all of that, so that we get a clear sense of where this little art science of managing expectation to come from and what it offers us. So the mindfulness is purposefully attending to whatever is occurring in the moment to moment with a mirror-like quality of mind. The mirror reflects everything objectively. It doesn't get affected by anything that it reflects. And this is the quality of mind that we all share. We all have this quality of mind, though it has degrees to which it's present in our sense. Sometimes we're very mindful. You know, we're climbing up a ladder. We pay attention to each rung and so forth. Other times we're mindless. An example of being mindless is driving or walking someplace, getting to where you actually intended to go and having absolutely no memory of how you got there. Anybody ever experienced that? Yeah. So that's mindlessness. No attention to what's happening. And yet we got there, you know, nobody got run over. So we need to recognize the difference between mindfulness and mindlessness. And then if you choose, make an actual effort to become more mindful. So how do we do that? We practice something called mindfulness meditation or insight meditation, which is a mental exercise to basically bring mindfulness in play. Further, and we'll do it, I'm gonna lead you in a 15-minute meditation, which will give you the opportunity to kind of drop off the tumult of the week. You know, drop it off, let your mind clear a little bit to the extent that that can happen. And then we'll move on from there into the, you know, to actually talking about the nature of expectations and all of that. So, this is one of the few venues that I speak at where you can actually get away with sitting for 15 minutes without saying anything. Hopefully that was a pleasant and useful experience. The Buddha says, by your own efforts, waken yourself, watch yourself, and live joyfully. You are the master. And that's kind of the mess. One of the messages in this book that I've written is that mindfulness becomes a base, a foundation for just about everything that that you choose to do. It gives you choice as opposed to just doing things out of some kind of habit. So that the more mindfulness you bring into your present way of operating, the more likely it is that you'll be able to manage anything and everything. So now, I'll tell you a story about a kayaking trip. The story is in the book, and it was actually triggered by my editor, Mary, who planned a kayaking trip with her friend. Mary's friend is in much better shape than Mary, but they both like kayaking. So they made this arrangement to go kayaking in Maine for a couple of weeks. And Mary can do about 7 miles a day, and her friend can do 15. But they never talked about that. So the expectation of Mary was that they would do 7 miles a day. It would be kind of mellow. It's like no heavy duty work. And her friend had this other expectation, which was basically that they will do 15 miles a day and they'll push, and you know, that's kind of their way of operating. So they get to the place where they're going to do the thing, and over a short amount of time they realized that there was frustration and anger and all of that kind of stuff going on, because each one of them had their expectation that wasn't being met. Bottom line is that they were faced with a decision, certainly to see what they could do going forward to create some kind of a peaceful set of mutually understood expectations, or go home, or you know, do something else, find a bed and breakfast and hang out for a while, whatever. But the message here is that they both had expectations. Everybody here has expectations, except for Ken has expectations. And do we manage them properly? Are they conscious? Are they rational? Are they mutually understood and agreed upon? And if they're not, what does that cause? What's the end result of not managing your expectations? So we need to expect expectations. We need to make sure that because they're a part of life, we are able to work with them in a way that is clever. Now, as I mentioned before, the enlightened don't have expectations. They don't really have that sense of having to know what the future is about. Because that's what expectations are. They're beliefs about how the future will unfold. How something will happen in the future is what an expectation is. And we can call it value, not value so much, but goals, objectives, any kind of projection into the future is setting up an expectation of how things will occur. So we expect that to happen, and therefore we have to be clever in making sure that our expectations are based on the most rational qualities that we can bring to mind. So what do we mean by rational expectations? Well, rational expectations begin with the notion that the only things that we can really be certain of are impermanence, continuous change, uncertainty, and disappointments. Yeah? So everything is impermanent. Everything is going to be moving from one current situation to another, to another, to another. There's this constant flow that's going on. That's the continuous change aspect of it. We have uncertainty because unless we're omniscient, we don't know how things are going to turn out, right? And from time to time, things will not come out the way we would like them to. Okay. We'll be disappointed. How many people have found that they've been disappointed once or twice, you know, across the years? So So we've got all of these basic things that we can be pretty certain of, yeah? And if we start our management of expectations, whether they're our own expectations or the expectations of some client that we might have or some boss or a partner or what have you, if we start the understanding of our expectations with that notion in mind, then it's much more likely that we'll end up with something that can actually be achieved. You know, a rational expectation is one that can be met, yeah? So we have many expectations that have no possibility of being met. Yeah? We have many more that have a really, really tiny probability of being met. Yeah? And these occur in business, they occur in home life, everywhere. Yeah? So our goal is to now base our expectations on this level of reality, and then from there, operate in a way that includes our ability to communicate with the other people involved, if there are other people involved, or with ourselves, to investigate and explore how best to manage these expectations. So one of the reasons I wrote this book was to put this message out there, a message that I'm hoping will help people to avoid some unnecessary suffering. Now, I had other reasons for writing this book. Many of them are ego-based, like I like to write. I like the idea of passive income, royalties, you know. I like to have my name in print, you know, and on the websites. But basically, the underlying motivation here is how can you use this information to make your life easier and better, and make the life of the people around you, even if they don't know how to manage expectations, how can you help them to not go off thinking that things are gonna come off in a way that is not particularly the way they're gonna happen, yeah? Now, if people don't have rational expectations, they tend to suffer. Yeah? So what is suffering? You know, they suffer because they're disappointed. They get angry. You know, how many of you have had the expectation that other people on the road would actually drive in a way that that was rational and wouldn't cut you off? Yeah? So you have this expectation, then somebody cuts you off, and all of a sudden you're angry. You know, you're going to cut them off back. You know, all of that kind of stuff goes on. Or, you know, you have many, many different instances of this. I don't have to go through those examples. You know them, yeah? You all have your examples of how your expectation leads you into a place where you're going to be hurting yourself by being angry or depressed or what have you, yeah? And then on top of that, you've got the situation where other people are going to be upset because they might expect something from you that isn't going to come out the way that they would like it to be. Further, you have expectations of yourself. You know, you get cut off, you get angry, but you're not supposed to get angry, right? You expect to be calm and cool and collected all the time, but yet this anger appears, yeah? Imperfection. So because your expectation perhaps is that you're going to be this perfectly equanimous, you know, totally cool person, and you find that you're not, that could cause some problems, yeah? So we see that these expectations work in a number of different dimensions and directions with respect to our way of operating. So that we want to now get a sense of what, certainly from the point of view of our own expectations of ourselves and the expectations that we're creating by making promises to people, setting up projects and so forth that, you know, have deadlines and cost constraints and all of this stuff, or getting into a relationship and having that relationship being based on a set of expectations that are unknown to both of the parties, like the kayaking trip, and on and on and on. So what we need to do is get a sense of what is performance like? What can we expect in the way of performance? How do we optimize that performance? And how does that relate to the other part of the title in this book, Achieving Success, Mindfully Achieving Success? Yeah. So performance, we're all performers. You know, some in some way we are performing in a movie that we're actually starring in, directing, have written, and so forth. So here we are in this performance. And within this performance, we're doing dance, we're doing programming, we're doing whatever it is that we do in order to earn a living, have fun, etc. So, but it's all performing, yeah? And everybody does this. Then we have the understanding of optimal performance. You know, anybody can just perform. I mean, it's kind of built in. You can just be mindlessly walking down the street or whatever. But we want to perform optimally. Now, what does optimally mean? Well, optimally means that given the fact that we're faced with objectives that are usually at odds with one another, that have a sense of being more or less conflicting, we're faced with a certain capacity to do something, we're faced with a set of skills associated with that capacity, some tools, other people around, and so forth. Optimally performing is basically performing as best as you can given the current circumstances, given your conditions that are at hand. How can you operate most effectively and sustain that over time? So we're not talking about peak performance, we're talking about optimal performance. Peak performance happens, but it's not sustainable. Yeah? So we're talking about now, how do we manage in that way that allows us to be optimal performers? And then, how do we get over the fact that somebody has told us, for those in the community of Buddhists and yogis, that you're not supposed to do anything. You know, it's like everything will take care of itself. Well, that might happen, but I wouldn't count on it. So the goal is to cultivate your capabilities so that you can perform in a way that meets your own objectives, your own expectations, and the expectations of the people that are relying on you in one way or another, or expecting something from you in one way or another. So there's a certain set of factors that come together to both enable well-managed expectations, but also to manage and optimally perform. Those factors, we start with mindfulness. I said, that's the base. You know, if you're not aware of what you're doing, then the likelihood of doing anything right or wrong becomes random. So we don't want to rely on random activities. Awareness of your situation, of your environment. What are the other people like? What are the rules of the game? How does the whole environment, the organization, the community, the social networks and so forth, how do they work? So we need that to be brought into play. We need effective planning, the ability to understand that we can set up a plan of action and then, based on that plan of action, get a sense of how good our expectations really are in terms of rationality. We can then follow that plan and perform. But as we're doing that, we need to be able to monitor and adjust, adapt to what's happening in the present moment. We need clear, candid communication because we're working with other people. We're working with also ourselves. How do we communicate with ourselves in a way that sends messages that are meaningful? So effective communication, managed expectations, of course, using those factors, managed conflict, because as we're working with other people, it's inevitable that some kind of conflict or disagreement is going to arise. So how do we manage that in an effective way? And then manage change, since changes are given. How do we go about managing that in a way that makes sure that we're not disrupting the world around us and that we're making the best out of a situation that we might not even like, you know? So that's a lot of factors. They have to be folded together in a way that makes things work really properly. Now, folding all of those factors together, along with the relative insanity of most people, including myself, requires more than some kind of an intellectual, analytical approach. You know, this requires really sitting back, relaxing into this very complex situation that we find ourselves in, and then allowing our skills, our intelligences, and so forth to come forth in a natural way, and then we start operating. Then we can operate in a way that is really, really organically correct. Then we start achieving success. So this is another word in the title, success. Now, some of the more orthodox Buddhists and yogis say that the desire to achieve success is taking one away from the from the notion that there's nothing to gain and nothing to lose. Yeah. And if you're at that place where gain and loss have no longer any meaning, success or failure have any no longer have any meaning, everything is just equanimous. How many of you are that in that kind of space? Only Ken. So, and I'm sure even he has moments. So we have this this notion that we want success. Yeah. So what do we mean by success? Well, in the bottom line of looking at it from the point of view of expectations, success is satisfying expectations. Yeah. You're successful with respect to yourself if you satisfy the expectations that you have about yourself. If you're doing a project, you're successful if your expectation about hitting a deadline and staying within budget meet the expectations that you've set and that other people have bought into and so forth. If you're a salesperson, success means making the right amount of sales and so forth. Yeah. So we get this notion of success being identified in some way and recognizing that that way is defined by a set of characteristics that we set up, a set of criteria that we set up. Yeah. So that criteria is going to now bring us into a place where we have to plan to do a set of things to enable us to achieve that set of criteria. How do we do that? Again, it goes back to planning, it goes back to controlling, to adapting to, to the current situation and so forth. So we try to achieve success. Now, success, in some people's mind, is associated with perfection. So do we want to be perfect? Is there anything wrong with wanting to be perfect? I'd like to be perfect. It's kind of one of my expectations is that at some point in time, I will achieve perfection. But I also realize that perfection is more of a process than a place to be. So that it becomes necessary to not only understand that you want perfection, but to understand that part of being perfect is to have flaws, errors, yeah? Discord, part of the process. I'm told that Zen potters, master potters, impose a flaw in their pot to remind themselves that nothing is perfect without an imperfection. So we work with this notion and then are enabled to kind of forgive ourselves for being imperfect, but at the same time, because perfection is the process that we're born into and our expectation is that we're going to get more and more perfect, what we do is learn from the flaw, learn from the error. How can we not do that again? How can we see what we're doing in a way that will enable us to grow and to ultimately be perfect? Now, ultimately is a long time away. So you need to really get this notion of optimal performance includes imperfection. Yeah? So that expectation, coupled with the expectation of continuous change and so forth, gives us the ability to operate in a more kind way, kind to ourselves, kind to other people, relaxed, more accepting of what's going on, and at the same time having, you know, clear boundaries, clear understanding of where we want to go and how we're going to get there and all of that. So to recap, there's this desire for optimal performance and success. There's this sense of success being the ability to satisfy expectations. There's this notion that everything is impermanent, constantly changing, has a quality of unsatisfactoriness from time to time. And a goal is to consistently satisfy expectations by managing them effectively. So how do we manage them effectively? Well, we set the stage by expecting them to be rational, okay, which means that they can be accomplished, they can be met. We want them to be meaningful so that we can answer the question, why would you want to do that? Why would you have this expectation? You know, it's got to be meaningful in that sense of having value to meet that expectation. Mutually understood. We see what happens when we don't talk about our expectations. We don't clear them from the point of view of at least discussing them externally, or at least in some cases, just identifying them for ourselves and articulating them for ourselves. And then, are they mutually accepted? Because you can have a bunch of people who have mutually understood objectives, most mutually understood expectations, and those expectations are at odds with one another. It's good to know that, yeah? And then it's good to find a place where there's a meeting of the minds, or recognize and acknowledge that there'll never be a meeting of the minds and work with that. Yeah. So those are the kind of the basics of effective, healthy expectations. So how do we get there? How do we make sure that that's happening? Well, we start by setting expectations. We get either ourselves or a group of people together, a couple or whatever, and we start to say, okay, this is what we expect into the future. This is how we would like the future to unfold. We make sure that we now understand what our expectations are, and then we put together that plan that I mentioned before. What are the steps that we have to take? What are the actions that need to be put in place in order to achieve what we want to achieve? And as we're doing that, as we're planning, we start to see that some of the expectations that we might have had are totally irrational. They don't fit with what we consider to be a realistic plan. So we adjust, and then we start performing against the plan. And again, we might find that as we're doing that, we find that the plan is flawed. That leads us back to the fact that some of our expectations are no longer valid. And again, what do? We adjust if we're clever. Because if we're not so clever, then we don't adjust. And everybody starts to be stressed and strained in a way that is caused by trying to achieve the impossible. Yeah? Trying to achieve the impossible is the root cause of the suffering that people undergo. So we perform, we assess our performance regularly and perhaps continuously. We modify our performance, we modify our plans, we modify our expectations, and then we continuously adapt, recognizing that unless we can adapt to the current circumstances, nothing that we have put into place, no one of our expectations will really be realized. So we go through this iterative refinement process, and everybody becomes happy. So does this all make sense? This is a kind of a sense-making, thing. Makes sense, makes people happy, probably saves money in the long run. So why doesn't everybody do it? Yeah? Does everybody here manage their expectations in this way? So why don't we do it? Well, there's some reasons. One of the predominant reasons is that certainly in business and organizational settings, there are people in power who basically set expectations, and then there are other people who have to fulfill those expectations who don't have the courage to speak truth to power. Yeah? So it takes kind of courage to, you know, to do this work of managing expectations. It takes a sense of being confident enough in yourself and in the argument that you're going to bring forth to bring it forth, to bring it, yeah, to confront. And then through that confrontation, which, you know, can be very gentle and very diplomatic and so forth, but it's still a confrontation. Through that confrontation, what happens is that we start to resolve the irrationality, assuming that there's enough rationality to enable that, right? We know that there are very irrational people in the world who, no matter what you do, are not going to see the light. Yeah? I mean, maybe at some point in their evolution, they'll see the light, but, you know, in the near future, not going to happen. Recognizing that and not expecting that type of person to change in the near future, it's very healthy. Because it now sets up another level of expectation. Either go through the pain of disappointing them or get out of there, you know? So we work with that, but recognize that the barrier is there. The notion that that we need to do something, we need to make an effort. And then there's another interesting barrier to managing expectations. The assumption, the expectation, that everyone knows what they expect and that what they expect aligns with what everybody else expects. Yeah? So does that ever happen? You know, we make this assumption that could be correct, but unless we actually talk about it and actually express what our expectations are, get a sense of what the other people's expectations are, we're often running on a forced march to nowhere. Yeah? So we want to break through these barriers. We want to manage expectation by relying on blending together a relatively crisp analytical approach that deals with the numbers and the more concrete parts of the expectations, the things that can be expressed verbally and on paper and so forth. But we also have to balance that with the interpersonal, the softer aspect of it, the feeling tones that occur when we're expecting something and it doesn't come to pass. We have to deal with the expectation of some situation being in a certain way, calm, peaceful, friendly, etc. And recognize that that's an expectation too that needs to be discussed and needs to be reconciled with other people's ideas of what it means to be in a healthy relationship or in a healthy project or in a healthy organization. So we've got all of these things that we can be putting together, and the goal is to do it, you know, to do what you can do first intrapersonally, you know, to manage your expectations, and then interpersonally to manage, to the degree that you can, the expectations of yourself in the context of working with others. And it's by putting those two elements together that we start to find a bit more happiness going on. You know? We find success. We are success. One of the main aspects of success, as far as I'm concerned, is the ability to be relatively unconditionally happy. You know, it's like, that's success. But if it's built on some kind of expectation that the only way that I'm going to be happy is if I have $1 million, maybe that's not so clever. Yeah. So we work for ourselves, we work together, and we accomplish. Yeah. So hopefully that's been at least interesting, if not useful. And does anybody have any comments or questions that we can? Yes.
I definitely have a question.
Wait, hold on for 1 second. We have a microphone so that everyone can hear.
Let me see if my voice might be heard.
The microphone is has it disappeared?
No, the microphone never disappears, but it does not function.
Oh, okay. Is it on?
I believe that it's on.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
My question is, in your metaphor of speaking truth in power, how come so many organizations and so many projects, so many short-term and long-term projects, we find the people at the bottom, in your metaphor, straining and stressing rather than ever having people at the top levels modify their plans to be more valid, relevant, and realistic? How often do you see that change from the people at the top?
Well, this is a good question. I think that part of the problem is that the people in the middle don't inform the people at the top about the irrationality of their expectations. So if somebody comes up with an idea, let's put electric buses on the road in New York City, and let's do it in a year. You know, it's a great idea. So somebody high up, you know, the president says, let's do this. Yeah. Everybody, aye aye, sir. And nobody says, you know, that's not going to happen because we can't manufacture that many buses in that time frame, or it's going to take a year to put all of the infrastructure together, if not 2 years. Yeah, but nobody is willing to say that. Everybody is thinking that because the boss wants something to happen, that they're sold on that, and they're not willing to have any flexibility whatsoever. So nobody says anything, and we take there's a famous story about a trip to Abilene. You know, nobody says anything about the insanity of something, and everybody takes this unnecessary trip and takes them along in the road. So in some respects, in many cases, I find that it's upper middle management as opposed to the senior executives that are the cause of that problem. Now, that's not to say that all executives are enlightened and clever and capable of rational thought. You know, there are some that aren't. But for the most part, it's their desire, or at least I impose that on them, that it's their desire to have truth spoken to power. So I don't know if that answers your question fully, but I think that there's a lot of that going on in the world, and that's what causes the people in the trenches, so to speak, to have to work so hard. You're welcome. Yes. Speak right into the mic.
I had something happen today that was expectation-oriented. It was very important because it involved my livelihood. I got in arrears with my rent, and there was a program available that would pay it. And my landlord and I jumped through all the hoops that were required. The checks were sitting on a desk. And today, I was actually taking some tests on the computer for a new job. And I looked at my phone and my landlord said, call me by WAP. And when I called her, she said that they rejected the case person that was handling it. And then she went into expectations from there. Her expectations was now, you have to pay, you have to do this, and let me know by the end of the day. Talk to him and find out why.
Okay. So what's the question?
It isn't a question.
Oh, okay.
The comment is, for me, First of all, I wish I had finished my test and not returned a call, because in my expectations, I like to focus on one thing at a time. And I was taking a computer test, so next time I won't do that. But her expectations are different from mine. I did not call her today because I don't have tangible answers from her. First, I need to know the facts and why, and if there's anything else I can do about that. So my point is that when other people have expectations, until I had my expectations, tangible answers, just because she is my landlord, you know, I don't have an answer, and I'm not going to call her today or the weekend because it's something I can be done about. Okay.
That sounds like a wise approach. I mean, first, you know, the recognition that you didn't have to answer the phone, you know, and not to do that again. That's very clever. And then the next part is, you know, this notion of working with other people's expectations. That your landlord has her expectations. You need to know whether or not you can comply with some or all of them. You need to sit back, just as you're saying, and reflect and give it the time that's needed for you to do that. And at the same time, recognize that her expectation may be a call back in 20 minutes, a half an hour, one day. If you found out what that was and then said to her that, you know, you have to think about this and you have to reflect on it, it might make her a bit more calm and collected, as opposed to not knowing what her expectations are about a callback. And from that, she might start getting angry or feeling that you're dissing her in some way. You hear what I'm saying?
I'm just going to say one thing. I'm really at this point with people in my life, Brian. I really don't care. There's urgencies. I am a senior executive assistant. I work with CEOs. And so my time is so essential for time management. That's my job. It's like I have to be able to time manage. And in life, there's just because someone else says it's urgent doesn't make it urgent.
Absolutely.
And I don't have tangible answers for her, and I will tell her that. And when I do, there's a lot of things involved. He's incompetent.
Absolutely.
And I can talk to a supervisor, and it probably will be issued on Monday. So until I, you know, but I, in my life, I'm not going to let expectations upset me anymore. I'm tired of it, and I'm tired of overextending myself and stressing out. Mm-hmm. That's a really big thing, because we really, I mean, it's a lot of money, and we have it. And then he's said something, but I don't know.
You know, that's
where I'm at.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and you know, that may or may not be a clever place to be at and stay at. I mean, clearly it's a clever place to be at, because that's where you are. So now, how do you manage that in light of the fact that you live in a society where people have expectations, and not only expectations for themselves, but expectations of you? Now, if you can be in a situation where you don't have to take any negative effect from not caring about their expectations, then...
I don't mean it that I don't care. I mean, I will go according to urgency.
Of course.
Just because someone else says it's urgent, like she says, call me by the end of today, that I will tell her what I'm working on. I'm not going to react to another person's expectations.
Absolutely. You don't have to jump.
But I don't care, because it is my responsibility.
Okay. Because I heard.
I'm done with stressing myself out over other people's expectations.
It's a very good starting point for anything. Don't stress yourself out. Care about people, care about other people. And do whatever you can do within your power to be kind and compassionate. And if that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be you don't have to be a doormat. You don't have to recognize and try to satisfy people's expectations, whose expectations are irrational, but you do need to manage in the relationship. We have a question down here.
So my problem is
speak right into the
okay. Is it better?
Yeah.
So my problem usually is that even though I've heard this before, I usually tell my friends that about expectations, but sometimes even when the ones that are like, that's sort of like what I think that are achievable expectations sometimes don't turn out to be the way that I want them. And even when I'm there, I'm frustrated. I don't know how to do that.
Okay.
I feel like I made that spot. Like I already know that probably, you know, that things really don't turn out always the way that I want them to. But even when they don't, I still feel like I failed somehow.
Anybody can relate to that? That's, you know, kind of a universal position to be in. So the first thing we do is we keep reminding ourselves that one of those realities that I mentioned is disappointment. That it is likely, highly likely, if not inevitable, that there will be disappointing things that occur. So if we realize that, that puts us at least with an expectation that this could happen. Now when it happens, we start to feel all of the negative emotions that come up when we're disappointed, yeah? We're angry, we're depressed, all of that. So what to do with that? Now, if you're a mindfulness practitioner, as I think you are, what you do is you start to say, okay, there's a feeling. Anger is arising. Disappointment is arising. And you start to slightly distance yourself from it without turning it off, experiencing it fully, and knowing that this is an afflictive emotion or like a feeling that is negative. It's there, and I accept it for what it is. And then, upon reflection, you might find that disappointment is caused by clinging to something, trying to, or expecting things to be something that they can't be, you know? And so that on a kind of a more logical level, you can accept that and see that the process that you went through that caused your initial pain, your disappointment, whatever, is something that you can work with. And then you don't expect to be perfect. So it's okay to be disappointed when you're disappointed. It's okay to be angry. Yeah, you just have to be skillful enough not to throw your anger out at somebody. Yeah, and then you slowly, slowly become more and more enlightened, and then those things don't happen. You know, you get something like Canada.
Oh, thanks, George.
Bernie.
Thank you. I've been mourning.
wait for the microphone.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's good. I can project.
No, don't project. Wait for the microphone.
I have an expectation. Anyway, you know what I wanted to ask you? Maybe it would be helpful to me and everyone else. The thing that you were saying was...
Into the mic.
Oh, okay. To be in a kind of constant referral or assessment as to how things are proceeding in relation to expectations, goals, and then making adjustments. What further can you share around how to get better at that? Because that's the skill you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, you know, I have a very simplistic view with respect to that capability. It's if you practice mindfulness meditation, you're going to ultimately get better on a regular basis at being able to see what's going on, recognize it for what it is, and then adapt to it. That's, you know, that's kind of the baseline. Now, until that happens naturally as an organic part of your brain, you go through the process of contriving it to some degree. So if you're in a project situation, you basically make every week a status meeting, you know? Okay, how are we doing? You know, we look at it, we had this as our plan, this is what actually happened, and there's a difference there. You know, and the difference is usually not a positive difference, so now what can we do? You know, so we get a bunch of people together who have at least the understanding that it's likely that you won't get exactly what you expect, and now we adjust. So you can set it up as a systemic part of your process. And that will, coupled with some degree of mindfulness, will now enhance your ability to do that adjusting. I don't know where the mic is, but, right there.
Then when you began, you described mindfulness. I don't know if you remember the first word you said was purpose.
Yes.
Would you mind repeating that slowly so I can write it down? Because I'm pretty sure it's going to change my life forever. So I have to get every word.
Okay. Mindfulness is purposefully paying attention with a mirror-like quality of mind. The mirror simply reflects. It does not judge. What is reflected does not change the mirror.
One more time.
Mindfulness is purposefully paying attention with a mirror-like quality of mind. The mirror simply reflects. It does not judge. What is reflected does not change the mirror.
Okay, sorry. Somebody's handing me a piece of paper with this written on it.
Ah.
And I just want to hear from your mouth.
Even better.
Okay, I'll get another piece of paper. I do have a comment sort of question. I think it's been only about 2 to 3, 4 years that mindfulness, people are saying mindfulness. Oh, I'm mindfully doing this. I'm mindfully doing that. It's sort of like, 20 years ago, people did yoga, so I might have something to talk to them about, a teacher, whatever. Now I'm doing yoga, it's like getting your nails
done. Right.
And it's mindfully, I'm mindfully putting my shoes on. I mean, people use it, and, well, I guess I'm getting irritated at the way it's being used, because it doesn't seem mindful. But it's in the culture now. And schools are using it, mindfulness in schools. It's just, I know you have an answer, so I'll release my agitation.
Okay.
About the sort of the pedestrian use of mindful.
Yeah, you're not alone in that irritation. I mean, there's a whole vast community of mindfulness experts that are upset about that. You know, it's the gentrification of mindfulness. And then there are different takes on what mindfulness actually is. You know, there's the quality of the Western management people are basically saying that mindfulness is simply paying attention to something. You know, being mindful of not spending too much money or something like that. So there's that component of it. And then there's the, when we talk about mindfulness in the meditative aspect is really, certainly it's not a two-year-old thing. You know, I've been practicing mindfulness meditation since like the mid-1970s, and then it was 2,000 years old or 3,000 years old. So this is something that's there. Now, the notion that it's becoming too popular is true, and it becomes something that loses its meaning unless it's taught in a way that allows people to really understand what's underpinning it. So right now we're in a situation where we've got a stream of mindfulness thinking that has to do with stress relief, mindfulness as stress relief. We've got, and you know, nothing wrong with that. It's, you know, it's coming from a health related component, and it's very, very useful, very needful, similar to yoga. You know, it's like basically, you do yoga, your body gets a little bit better if you don't pull anything, and ultimately you're going to be healthier. Yeah, so there's that component of it. But the underlying base is that by cultivating mindfulness, you will be more capable of making appropriate decisions. You'll be in charge as opposed to being subject to your unconscious belief systems and habits. Now, in schools, if that could be taught to a classroom of young people, in a way that was kind of easy for them to get, and you started cultivating this quality of mind that actually reflects on what's going on, reflects on how feelings quickly emerge as, behaviors, If you could do that, that's wonderful. It doesn't matter what you call it, but that's wonderful. Yeah? If people are walking around saying, oh, I'm mindfully tying my shoes, and they don't have a clue what that really means, then they need to go to a class. You know, we have, you know, classes here. They could take a class on MSBR and MBSR or on mindfulness for the purpose of liberation or whatever. But there's going to be a large number of people who want to make money off of mindfulness, who want to popularize it in a way that loses the underlying meaning. That's going to happen. You know, it's, I expect it to happen. It happens all the time, you know?
Yeah, you know, I do, you know, I do this work in high schools.
Yeah,
in the relationship skills program. And I've been hesitant to put mindfulness in our curriculum because the West Texas School Board has a lot to say over
yes.
what gets published in curriculum. So if you just do a word search for mindfulness,
yes.
you'll see Buddhist
These
West Texas ain't gonna have no mindfulness down here, you know.
Find another word.
Right, but I think where it's also being brought into a lot of inner city schools.
Yes.
And college, and I think for those kids especially, it's sort of like meditation. They do a meditation practice, and there's all sorts of stuff about how these kids are being more present and doing better with their grades. So
let me make a suggestion.
Yeah.
We have an expert on the integration of mindfulness into the school system right amongst us. Talk to one another, because I think that you'll have a lot to share. But certainly teaching anything about relationships without having that component of mindful awareness, I don't know how you could do it. You know, there has to be that sense of looking at your own internal process before you're able to even work with another person relationally.
So that's why we use the non-mind communication.
Yeah, yeah.
Out of the habitual judging.
Yes.
Which I think is couldn't be anything more mindful than to reduce the programming that we have to judge someone.
Absolutely. So you're just finding another word for it. You know, it's another term, it's another little system that takes it out of any kind of religious connotation or ism of some sort and sees it as a technique. Mindfulness is a technique. It's a tool that we might use. Now, there's some controversy that says that you can use the tool for any number of purposes. You can be like a sniper and be very mindful. You can be an assassin and be very mindful. And then there's another school of thought that says that simply by being mindful, you will almost automatically come in touch with the compassion and loving kindness and equanimity and sympathetic joy that is your birthright. Whether that, you know, whichever way it goes, still have mindfulness as a technique. If you don't couple it with a bit of wisdom and with some kind of ethical behavior, you're going to go nowhere. So how do we put those things together and cut out all of the isms? Cut out all of the, you know, the things that some school board in Texas is going to object to. And if, you know, people object to the fact that one can be more consciously aware of what's going on and cultivate kindness and loving, you know, and compassion, then, you know, something's wrong with them. Yeah? Thanks. So, oh, we have another question. Okay.
Yes, my name is Carlos. I found out when I I usually practice when I'm doing a project management, doing a work plan.
Uh-huh.
Describing the project, the objective, and the activity. And prioritizing the activity by dates. It works in companies. People have to comply.
Yeah.
When you apply that to relationships,
it's got to be much more subtle. Projects are easy. Relationships, on the other hand, are not so easy. So they're much more complex. And usually are taking place in a situation where there's no formality. So, you know, in a project, you got formality. You got people who, you know, who are going to own up to the fact that you got to write things down and, you know, count things and do all of that stuff. You're in a relationship, it's supposed to just happen. You know, it's like these two people that went on a kayaking trip, you know? They expected everything to be known and, you know, they never discussed anything. So now, when you go to Michael's class on relationship, you start to learn that you can talk about things in a way that is almost like planning. It's not as analytical, but it's certainly about, you know, what do you expect? What do I expect? You know, how can we come to a conclusion about that? You know? So you're doing the same thing, but you're doing it in a different way that's more situationally appropriate. And it's the subtlety of knowing how formal and how informal that process of communication needs to be before you can really get to a place of feeling that you're skilled in this kind of expectation management. So it's that subtlety that you would bring to bear in relationships. And it's much more difficult than in a, you know, in a project where you're trying to build something or you know. Yeah? So hopefully this has been useful and interesting. I always find these the question and answer part of it much better. Thank you. All right, thanks. So there's food, drink, no alcohol.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.